Here we go with another exciting episode of the questions. Here we go. Number one. Why do you say that when vijnana has been translated as consciousnesses makes a lot of difference? It is because when one of the candidates says consciousness, people think it's a continuous process. So that consciousness is like the eternal soul. But it's not that. When you see that always vijnana in the suttas by the Buddha was always translated as the, is always explained as the six different types of consciousness. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and knowing. So it's six different types of consciousness. And anybody who knows their Greek philosophy. Actually, Nicholas, you were Greek extraction. Do you know Greek philosophy? All I know is I know English philosophy, Winnie the Pooh, and and also say American philosophy, which was Snoopy Dog. But when it comes to Greek philosophy, there was Plato, always had six senses: sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and the mind, the sixth sense. And Plato would always call the sixth sense the mind, the common sense. He said it was the common sense because whatever you see, whatever you hear, whatever you smell, whatever you taste, whatever you feel in your body, the mind always knows it as well. So the mind consciousness is common for all the other five. However, somewhere in history, over 2,000, almost, Plato was just a little bit sort of after the Buddha, 2,300 or 400 years of history. The Western world, we've only got five senses left. Somehow or other, we lost our mind, and with it, our common sense. So, six senses makes it a lot different. So it's not consciousness, consciousnesses. When there's six different types of consciousnesses, then you can actually understand just these are totally different things. Only that what you see, the mind knows afterwards. What you hear, the mind knows. What you smell, taste, touch, the mind knows afterwards. And what you know you knew. This is what happens with consciousness. And once you can separate those things out, you realize there's nothing continuous from one moment to another. All different types of consciousness. So your consciousness is not a continuum. It is particular, fragmentary, with nothing going from one to the other. As the Buddha said, like those garlands people wear, like a string of pearls, but with no string going through them. That is this process we call a stream of consciousness. And a stream of consciousness, it does look continuous from a distance. But you start looking closer, and that stream, the water which is flowing, you look closer, and all it is a molecule. That's all. Nothing really there. So that is different molecules. They're not continuous. There's spaces between them. I like the idea of space. Because I like, as a scientist, spacing out. Because you look at the floor which you're sitting on. What is it? It is just, cellulose cell. But they're not even touching. They look even closer, and they're just a few molecules. And between those molecules is lots of space, and when you get to actually the atoms, that's really cool, because it's just so tiny little bit of stuff there, and it's 99.9999999999999999999% emptiness. It's not really there, it's just forces. And you go into the nucleus where all the major stuff is, and there's nothing there. It's just this is a bunch of protons and neutrons and lots of space in between them. And it's 99.9999999999% nothing. And you're looking through, you know, what is actually a proton? Just a few quarks. And between them, nothing there. But most of what you're sitting on now is actually empty. Nothing really there. Now always remember, I'm going to be very careful because there's another theoretical physicist sitting over there. So, you have always was really amazed to see that from the sun, there's all these subatomic particles, neutrinos, billions of them passing through your body right now. You don't feel it. As far as those neutrinos are concerned, you are empty space. That's why they just pass through you. There's nothing there. So, when you actually look really careful, there's nothing there. That's the truth of it. That's really cool. And that's only on a small scale. Look at the big scale. This great universe of ours. What is there? Mostly empty space. Nothing is really there. So there's so much space, so much emptiness, so much nothing there. I really feel that's cool. I like. That's why people ask me, Ajahn Brahm, you've really helped me. Is there anything you like? And I say, yes, nothing. Ho, ho, ho. And that is the power of now. What is the present moment anyway? N-O-W, now. And what's in the center of now? Zero. And what's in the center of zero? Nothing. It's empty. A beautiful letter zero. Nothing is inside. That's what I really like. Anyway, the same as how are you going in your meditation? Are you getting anywhere in your meditation? Or are you getting nowhere? If you're getting nowhere, well done. Because what does nowhere spell? Now and here. Figure it out. So if you're now and here, you're getting nowhere, that's what you're supposed to be doing. Come on. Be now, be here. Now here. Otherwise pronounce no. They pronounce it nowhere, but it should be really pronounced now here. Hee hee hee. Dear Ajahn, deep acceptance of body and mind seemed a subtle thing. Sometimes there is measuring down and dejection not good enough arises. It is then a matter of practicing kindness until one knows the relationship that is closer to the matter that relaxes and let things be, rather than rejecting what is present for an imaginary better state. Yeah, sure. So you're always going to something better. Well, there's always nothing really better. Sometimes you go to the husband's shop and exchange your husband for a better model, and you still see, you know, just the fault is endemic in all husbands. You know, you can't sort of fix it up. You know, you have a recall for things, but then you get it back again, it's the same thing. So because of that, it's not trying to get it better. It's actually just learning how just to be with what you have. And you realize it's more than good enough. Better than you ever expected. Remember that story of the old monks don't lie? Right here, right now, in the nowhere, the now here, that's where you find a treasure greater than your wildest dream. And many of you have been telling me in your interviews you had some pretty wild dreams. So this is better than your wildest dreams. So you don't measure. Now, back to science. Somebody, I don't know why they asked me this, but thankfully they did. There was one of the founders of the Royal Society in England called Lord Kelvin. And people know Lord Kelvin because Kelvin is known for the absolute scale of temperature. Not degrees Fahrenheit, not degrees centigrade, degrees Kelvin. He was a great engineer, scientist, and he was also a philosopher as well. He was the one who said, if you want to control nature, you have to measure her, first of all, accurately. It was the start of the Industrial Revolution. In order to be able to actually to have technology and engineering, you have to have accurate clocks, accurate standard lengths, standard weights, so that you could actually find out what's going on in this world and control it. Measure first, control afterwards. Otherwise, no. So I've been looking at the news on the internet about Facebook getting your, is it metadata? Somebody told me it's called metadata, which means, I thought that's pretty good. That means loving kindness data. Is that what it means? Only one thing. Oh, that's a problem. But anyway, that's what people do. They find out who you are, your preferences, where you are, locate you, and they can control you. Measuring accurately, Lord Kelvin said, was a means to control nature and sometimes human beings as well. But it's great being a monk, because being a monk, it's very hard to measure you. The reason is because, as actually, still hasn't got this card yet. I went to get a senior citizen's card. Senior's card. Now, from Centrelink, that's the social security, whatever. But I had to identify myself, prove who I was. So they asked me when I went there, so, can you prove who you are? I said, I've been trying to do that for 43 years as a monk. Still haven't found me. They didn't think that was funny for some reason. This is government workers don't have a sense of humor. They said, well, come on, have you got your marriage certificate? Come on. Have you got your bank account details, your credit card, your driving license? No, 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 no. So it's really hard to prove who you are when you're a monk or a nun, which is great. You know, there's something which is really sort of karmically appropriate about that. But anyway, eventually found out, you know, who you were. Sometimes people believe me. Most times not. But anyway. So we have all these things to measure us. But what happens when you don't measure? When you don't measure, you can't control, you can't put people into boxes, you can't say you're a good meditator or a bad meditator, or you're intelligent, no, you're not intelligent, you're old, no, you're young. When you don't measure, you don't control. It's one of the reasons why, if you want to let go, stop measuring. Because then you can't do anything. Good meditation, bad meditation. What day of the week is this? How long have you been meditating? What time is it? You don't really know. You don't know how many more minutes there is until we finish. You don't know how many days you've been meditating for. You can't sort of get, okay, I've got to pack my bags tonight. When you don't measure, you can't control. So that's one of the reasons why, with the mind, your meditation, never measure, oh, this is a good meditation, this is a bad meditation. Oh, I'm peaceful, I'm not peaceful. See if you can just be without measuring. You can't control anything. Which means you have to let go. So easy. When you have no preferences. That's Zen, third Zen patriarch. I'm being heretical again. Switching traditions. But that is so true. That's why, you know, try not to measure you guys, you girls, whatever. Why measure? You're just human beings, that's all. And you know the word for measuring in Pali is manati. It's a causative from the word mana, mind. So that's actually what mind does, it measures things. So if you stop measuring things, you just let things be, then your mind stops doing stuff and you vanish. You've got to measure. Measure first, do later, and just get more eager. Fascinating. The philosophical explanation to the meaning of the world by Ajahn Brahm. Is that subtle? See? You measured again. Stop it. Remember what I said, if I ask you a question, be quiet. It's always a trick one. So that's why we think a better state, a better job, or whatever. Stop measuring these things. Dearest Ajahn, how do you deal with difficult situation in life and decide what is the best solution, whether it's an escape or not? Thank you, Ajahn. If there's something to do, you give it everything you've got. If there's nothing to do, you sit down and have a cup of tea. It's so easy. That is what Ajahn Chah taught this fellow from Sydney who came. This Zemin is one of those stories which wasn't in any of his books because he came to see me and told me because he didn't tell anybody else at the time. He had been in Sydney, heard about Ajahn Chah, went to Thailand, found him, and just went up there to ask a question. That's all he went to Thailand for, just to see this great monk and ask his question. But there were so many people surrounding Ajahn Chah, a hundred or a couple of hundred, and he waited and waited and waited and waited and waited until he realized that there's no hope at all of him seeing Ajahn Chah. Too many other people talking about stuff. And then what happened? He got up to go back. His taxi was ordered and it wouldn't be coming for another hour. So he saw monks sweeping the ground. And so he thought, well, nothing else to do. I might as well just do some good karma. So he went, picked up a broom, was sweeping. And that is when he felt this hand on his shoulder. And he turned around and that hand belonged to Ajahn Chah. The Ajahn Chah had seen him and, I don't mind saying this, Ajahn Chah could read minds. And so he actually just, saw this guy came a long way and decided to give him a little teaching. Such a simple teaching. He said, if you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got, and then left. And this gentleman from Sydney, he told me that he realized this was not just trying to get more work out of him, like your boss at work. If you're going to sort of work. It wasn't that, it was something much more powerful. And he thought about it, this is what he told me, he contemplated on the way home, he realized that if you are working at work, then just focus on the work, don't focus on the lunch break, don't focus on what's going to happen in the evening. When you're with your family, give your family total focus, give it everything you've got. When you're resting, give it everything you've got. When you're playing, give it everything you've got. When you're eating, focus on eating, you don't focus on anything else. And he said that made him so successful in life, healthy, had his business really flourished, and got a wonderful family as well. Very similar to the Emperor's Three Questions. Now the most important time, the one in front of you is the most important. Give everything you've got and care. And he said it was very successful. And he said, he realized that, I was a disciple of Ajahn Chah, so couldn't say thank you to Ajahn Chah, so I said thank you to me. That is actually how we know what to do. If it's sleepy time, time to go to bed, then give everything you've got. Just go to bed. If you get up in the morning, you're having your breakfast, give everything you've got. When you're meditating, you're not thinking about work or family, you're just giving meditation everything you've got. And most importantly of all, before you leave tomorrow and you pass the donation box, give it everything you've got. that never worked. But anyway, it's always worth a try. Strip your assets. I can't do stuff like that. Anyway, Ajahn, during meditation, whilst I have thoughts coming up, is it okay if I tell myself I value stillness, silence as a reminder to let go? You can tell yourself, but just do it very softly. Otherwise, it becomes another thought. The old story, the four monks who were meditating with a vow of silence when one of them sneezed. And the first monk said, bless you. Second one said, you've just broken your vow of silence. Third one said, so have you. And the fourth one said, I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet. So in other words, just you're trying to keep quiet and you say you value stillness. Yeah, it's okay to do that, but do it very softly and only once. Don't say, I value stillness. I value stillness. Like, I value stillness. Got it? Otherwise. But before I start meditation, it's okay for me to think of happy or fun events or think about things I'm grateful for. It seems a distraction, or is it good for energy? Thanks. It's good for energy. Sometimes it gets you in the right mood. One of those other stories with Ajahn Chah is in my mind now. Just before Ajahn Chah sort of had his illness, now he was getting more and more sick, and that the Western monks, really, you know, we actually looked in the old books, and in the time of the Buddha, it's in the Vinaya, they had saunas. So saunas were not invented in Sweden. Buddhists got there much earlier. So they had saunas for monks' good health. So we decided to build a sauna in Wat Bananachat for our teacher Ajahn Chah, for his good health. That was maybe 50%. The other one was so he could come and visit every week. And it worked perfectly, especially the visiting. Every week he'd come for his sauna, and that meant he could give us a talk. And with Ajahn Chah, you know, maybe Ajahn Brahm as well, sometimes you hit the spots, the talks are amazing. Sometimes, yeah, you've heard that before, but it's still useful. But on this occasion, he came and he just really hit the spot. And, oh, really inspiring. And after the talk, yeah, I just, you know, just so amazing, really inspired. And all the other monks were going to help him just, you know, at the sauna. So I went behind the hall and meditated. Oh, really beautiful meditation, really deep stuff. And as soon as I came out afterwards, you know, really blissed and happy and clear and very grateful as well, you know, to people who taught you. So I thought, maybe there's an opportunity, still an opportunity to do some service for my teacher. So off I went towards the sauna. I was too late because I saw him coming the opposite direction with, you know, two Thai attendants. One of them was the driver taking him back to his monastery, which was 6 kilometers away. So we're gonna pass on the path. And that was one amazing time because one of those great experiences I had with my teacher, because as we came closer, you know, he looked at me, he could tell all over my face, I was really blissed out, had a good meditation. And I can say this now because, you know, Ajahn Chah passed away. I could feel him inside my mind. He was checking me out. You know, reading minds. And for once, I didn't mind at all. I was actually quite happy to open the doors up because, you know, it's like your room is nice and tidy. Most times, no, don't come in here. I'm embarrassed. That's why I say, you know, you don't have to worry about monks or nuns reading your minds. You know, you read one mind, you don't want to ever read a mind again. Trash novel. What goes on? Do you really want to open the door for inspection of your own mind? Some of what goes on in there. But anyway, this time it's really pure and wonderful. And so, yeah, come inside. Make yourself at home in my mind, Ajahn Chah. And so he came inside. You know, this is how you feel, how you just know these things happening. And then when he finished, he looked at me and he said, Brahmavangsa. That was, you know, not Ajahn Brahm is short. It's hard enough for people to say Ajahn Brahm. Went to this school in this Mercedes College in Perth. And I gave a talk, really tried my best to explain about Buddhism and meditation to these 14, 15-year-old girls. You know what happened afterwards? That I saw them in town the next day, I'm not quite sure what, and they passed me on the street, and they say, Ah, you're the monk who gave this talk in our school yesterday. I said, wow, I'm really surprised you remember me. They say, I will never forget you. Oh, isn't that cute? How can you ever forget a monk called Ajahn Brah? There's an M on the end, please. You know, the girls try, you know, that age, you always try to wind you up. And so, yeah, where was I going? Oh, yeah. What's this going with that one? Oh, Brahma Wangso, yes, that's right. Brahma Wangso, he said. And you know, obviously, just to get my attention. And he said, why is that experience? Tamai, why? And he was really sort of catching, he was a very powerful monk, Ajahn Chah. And then I replied, I don't know. And my mind was clear, but you know, still stupid. Still not much wisdom there. Clear mind, but you know, not enough sort of understanding. And you know that when you really make a mistake like that, you know, the great teachers, they never scold you. They just laugh. They think it's so funny. Just how these students with great degrees in theoretical physics from Cambridge University can be so dumb. Very embarrassing and humiliating sometimes, but oh, it's great, because then he looked at me again after finishing laughing and he said, Brahma Wangso, I will tell you the answer. I thought, this is really cool. I'm going to get the answer to this really deep question, why, from one of the greatest, wisest, enlightened monks in Thailand at the time. Why? He's going to tell me the answer. And I was just really paying full attention. He said, what's the answer to the question, why? And he said, Brahma Wangso, the answer is, my mirai, which translates as, there's nothing. And he looked to me with a lot of metta, a lot of kindness. He said, do you understand? And I said, yes. And then he said, no, you don't. And he walked away. He felt so deflated, so tiny, like a little red ant crawling on the path. So much for my great education. But it was kindness, because, you know, you just, that's the answer to the question why. There's nothing. And that was just so amazing, just emptiness, nothing there. Ooh, wonderful. So anyway, do you understand? The Rajan, is it possible to see the nimitta of another person? That means you can read minds. See a nimitta of another person? No. If you've got deep meditation, yes. We always mention that Ajahn Chah could do those sorts of stuff. But, oh, I suppose, I don't know what you're meaning there, if it's like seeing somebody, if it sees somebody who's dead, or seeing a sign of somebody who's had an accident, or seeing sort of somebody who's really in trouble, then maybe. You can see, just you close your eyes and see an image of them. But if it's like these brilliant, beautiful nimittas, usually not. Dear Ajahn, help! I'm still not enlightened after 9 days of retreat. What should I do? Thanks. Excellent. Here we go, this story. To try and explain for modern life what happens in meditation and why sometimes, you know, you don't get it in the first day or two, or in the first retreat or two. There was a gentleman who migrated from overseas to Australia. In his home country, he had a great degree, but when he came here, his qualifications were not recognized. Just like I was told, there was a top psychiatrist, he was a professor of psychiatry from the United States. And when he was invited to Sydney University for actually to teach for a year, the immigration said, I'm sorry, sir, but you need to be accredited with the College of Psychiatry in, in Australia before you can teach. He said, well, I'm a professor of psychiatry. He said, don't worry, sir, but everyone has to do this. So he had to do an exam. And they gave him the two books to study. And he said, whose name is on this book? And he said, it's my name. I wrote this book. But nevertheless, you have to do an exam on his own book. And if you think that's funny, they're even teaching meditation now or mindfulness. You have to be accredited in some places. So what qualifications have I got to teach meditation? I've got a degree in theoretical physics, but that's not a fat lot of use. So, it will come the time, I'm sure, to be able to teach meditation, that I'm going to have to study a book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, and do a test on it. It's probably going to happen, or something similar. Weird world we live in. Anyway, so that is about... Not in line. Oh, yeah, the story. So this refugee came over from overseas and he couldn't get a job teaching psychiatry. So they had to... He got a job anywhere. He got a job in a building site as a labourer. And he was working really, 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 really hard. At the end of the day, when he went home, his wife had to ask him, how did you go on today? And he said, oh, I worked really hard, but I never made any money at all. They sent me home. They didn't give me even a bus fare home. But he went there the second day, the third day, the fourth day. Still didn't get paid. And he thought, these people in Australia, they exploit refugees. They make them work really hard and they don't give them any money at all. Then I'm not going to go anymore on the building site in Australia. They're just racist, exploit refugees. So I'm going to just not go to work anymore. 4 days, really hard work. Haven't got anything yet. And his wife said, I'll go back on Friday. You're not doing anything else. And I said, okay. So off he went to work on Friday in the building site. He only worked about half a day. And the boss gave him this big pay packet. And he was really stunned. He went back home. He said to his wife, I've finally figured out how it works here in Australia. From now on, I'm only going to go to work on Fridays. So, I'm only going to meditate when I get the nimittas and jhanas. That's called payday. And the only reason it happens is because of all those meditations where you got nothing at all. You are building up your credit until your credit gets enough that you get your paycheck. And many of you who have been doing so much hard work on the building site of your body and mind. And it's only a matter of time that you are going to get the paycheck. As I often say, the check is in the mail. So just wait for it. It doesn't come now. Maybe come when you go back. It's coming. The 10 paramis. How these paramis affect our meditation practice. The paramis came way after the time of the Buddha. So how they came was in the bodhisattva practice, instead of actually trying to become enlightened, you just build up these spiritual qualities. And in Mahayana, they had 6 paramis. And you know what happened as soon as the Theravada found out the Mahayana had 6 paramis? We had to do better. So we made 10. Na, 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 na. We've got more paramis than you have. A lot of time, that's what happens. You know, I went to Sri Lanka, Anuradhapura. You know, there was a big, museum there. Because in Anuradhapura, they had the 2 big sects. You've got to be careful. Because I don't like sectarianism, so we don't practice sects. Okay, I won't go there any further. I think you've got the bad joke. But anyway, the 2 sects was the Mahavihari, and the Mahavihara, and the other one was, Abhayagiri. And the Abhayagiri and Mahavihari, they were competing against each other. This is what monks get up to. In order, it's actually gross, but anyway, they made these urinals, you know, the squat toilets. They cut them out of stone, and I forget which one was which. I think I saw it because the Mahavihari eventually dominated, and they had like the Abhayagiri monks written on the sort of the toilet bowl, so you could literally you can squat down and urinate on the opposition. And there was, you've seen those, have you? Oh, well, I've seen those, they're really funny. I just said, what do monks get up to? Because that was the opposition, and the way to really humiliate them, every time they squatted down on the toilet, you know, they saw these sort of the opposite type of monks on there, so they could urinate on it. Gross, isn't it? But that's what people get up to sometimes. So anyway, sometimes it is keeping up with the other part, have 10 parameters and 6 parameters, but they weren't part of the meditation practice in the old days. In the original Buddhism, all you did is have eightfold path. That was enough. Dear Ajahn, when a partner is meditating, when should you bring them back to awareness? How do you do it, and why would you do so except an emergency, of course? Well, just leave them alone when they're meditating. So if your partner is meditating, it's nice and peaceful and calm. Oh, what a wonderful thing that is. And just leave them there. When they come out, they come out. If it really is an emergency, and you think, oh my goodness, you know, have they stopped breathing? Are they dead or whatever? It's just, you know, they may not even be breathing, but if the body is warm, then they're just in a deep meditation. So please remember that, because this happens in... First of all, another monk which I got to know, Indonesian monk called Sudarmo. He's passed away now, so I can tell all the stories about him. Otherwise, if you tell the stories now, but people just go and just do experiments on him, just to find out is it for real, is it not for real. But this is a monk that he was decided to be a hermit, like a rishi, and over in the jungles of Java. And he told me the story personally. And he went over into the jungles, just it was still like an 8-piece sceptre, Anagarika, and went really deep in the jungles and meditated. And he said, as he was meditating, he said, this is how he said it to me. His English wasn't perfect, but you can understand it. He said, a big star came to him. He said he married the star. That's what he said, like united with it. And deep state of bliss. He didn't know how many days, because you know, in the jungle didn't have a calendar. But it was certainly a very long time, because when he came out from this meditation, really pristine, he noticed the jungle was different. That there was been a lot of destruction there. And he asked the local villagers, there had been a flood. You know, quite common in the jungles, rainstorms, rainforests. And he had been under a meter or two of water, been submerged. For a long time. And he said, it didn't really matter because when you're in those deep meditations, you are invulnerable. And, you know, this, when I first met him, before I knew who he was, I remember just, you know, walking with Venerable Menindo in Wat Pawan. And straight away, Steve was like, that's a really powerful monk. And so, you know, you went to see him and got some of the info on what he was up to. And he was also the monk. This was with another disciple I got to know. She was a Mom Luang. Right? She was a granddaughter of, I think, Rama the Sixth, I think. And anyway, she grew up in England. But she went to meditation every week over in Wat Pawan until she told me she couldn't go there anymore. It was during the meditation session, organized, run by this Sudarmo. She saw, you know, there's something really weird going on. She opened her eyes. And, you know, this was, you know, someone I've known for a long time. She said she absolutely swears to me this was true. She opened her eyes and she saw rays of light coming out from this monk into one of the meditators. Laser eyes. That's a pretty cool psychic power. Now, reading people's minds, yeah, you might get it right, you might not get it right. Just like that story, which this is actually, I forget where this was. This is like in, could be Ayutthaya, Thailand, a long time ago. You know, the king royalty always would have their ministers, and their ministers were always going to be like really wise people who were noted, you know, because how smart they were, or sometimes how witty they were, you know, to entertain the king. So anyway, there was this minister who was, you know, very, very smart, very sharp, but was just really irritating to all the other ministers. You know, was always, you know, getting it right and everyone else was wrong, and always the king's favourite. So in order to get their own back, they were so jealous of this minister that they had a meeting together and they said, this is our plan. This minister is really smart, but his weakness is he's proud and arrogant. But let's work on that. We'll have a conversation, you know, amongst us in front of His Majesty, to say that this minister is so wonderful, the king is so lucky to have a minister like this. He has got so many, many sort of skills and wisdom, and he's probably even got psychic powers. He probably can even read our minds. To try and lead him into saying he could read people's minds. And then, once he'd caught the bait, then they would ask him, well, prove it, read our minds, what are we thinking now? And even if he could read the mind, no one could prove the, what you're thinking, so you'd say something different. Suppose you were thinking, oh, you were thinking about lunch. So I can see you're thinking about lunch. And then you can say, no, I wasn't. You can't prove what you're thinking. So they were going to catch him out, even if they got it, if he got it right, they would say, no, you're wrong. Just to humiliate him in front of the king. That was the plan. So, the next day, they started praising this minister in front of His Majesty. Oh, so wise, so wonderful. And after a while, when they thought he was just bathing in the praise, oh, you can probably read people's minds. And the minister said, yes, I can. He said, okay, what are we thinking? Whatever he said, they were going to say, no, you're wrong. But this was one smart minister. In front of His Majesty the King, he said, all you other ministers, you are all thinking kind thoughts towards His Majesty. And they thought for a while, I said, yes, correct. That's how you read minds. I tell you, that really happened. Do you know who that was or something? It was one of the famous stories in old Thailand, anyway. So when a partner's meditating, when should bring them back to awareness? Leave them there. They're fine. And, because they're much better. But if their body is warm, then it means that, you know, they're in deep meditation, even if you can't see them breathing. So leave them alone. Why is it that insight meditation has taken such a widespread hold in America and perhaps the entire West? Is it because the jhana meditation is so difficult to achieve and that outside of retreats in daily life, it's very demanding to be able to achieve jhana? Mindfulness practices do bring peace and a little bit of the essence of Buddhism to daily life, and it's miserable grind. Miserable grind. Lay life. You know, I used to be a lay man. It wasn't always miserable. It's just how you look at it. It's troublesome, but, you know, make the best out of it. So anyway, why has it become widespread? Now, this is what I was told. First of all, told by the United Vietnamese Congregation, because then I've been over there, I'm quite well known over there, and they told me that some years ago they had a meeting and they decided not to teach jhana to lay people. It was banned. And the reason was they thought it was just too troublesome. You know, to get jhanas you have to, you know, really renounce a lot, so no monk or nun, Vietnamese nun, this Mahayana and Theravada could teach jhana to lay people. Believe it or not, too troublesome. And a similar thing happened in Burma when they thought, ah, it's too hard to to do jhanas for lay people, so we'll teach them vipassana instead. Mindfulness. It was a second-rate meditation. So what happened afterwards is, you know, that you can't keep secrets. And, you know, to someone born in the West, you can't sort of do stuff like that. The Buddha always said he never kept a closed fist. What was really necessary and meaningful, he would teach it to people. So, you get monks like myself and others, we go teaching jhanas. You know that one of those nuns, Ayakema, he came to Perth a long time, because she was Australian. I saw her when she was still a layperson with her husband Gert. And they came over to Wat Narachat when I was a young monk there. And later on she became a nun, so she was passing. She was Australian. Oh, actually had a monastery in Australia. She was Austrian. No, she was Australian. At least in then. She lived in Australia a lot. German Australian, yeah. So anyway, she was... He came through, so was I the abbot then? But anyway, I invited her to give a talk to the monks. So she gave a nice talk on jhanas. And she said, I'll probably really upset you by teaching jhanas. And I said, of course not. We teach this all the time here. She was actually quite surprised. But anyway, so you realize that in the time of the Buddha, people taught jhanas. Lay people got jhanas, so why not now? Didn't make any sense. And the thing is now, they say the truth is out, you can read the suttas for yourself. You can see what the Buddha taught. Like Gopika Moggallana Sutta. That is 108, you can write that down if you want. 108, Gopika Moggallana Sutta. That was just after the Buddha passed away. And the go-to monk would be Ananda. And this sutta was just after the time the Buddha passed away. And so the person went up to Ananda and asked many, many questions about what the Buddha taught. One of them was, what type of meditation did the Buddha recommend? And Ananda replied, the Buddha only recommended four types of meditation. What four types of meditation did the Buddha recommend? First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. And if you read it for yourself, jhana is just in every page. And this is one of the reasons why when people actually start to read these books, find it jhana. That's one of the reasons why that now people have studied and they've looked for themselves. They haven't followed monks, thank goodness. Because, sometimes you follow a monk, you follow a nun, or whatever, what they're saying. Have a look for yourself in the suttas. And they actually see what's really there. So, it's more difficult, but, if you really want to sort of develop these states, people do them, they get them. Lay people come on retreats, maybe sort of do a little bit of simplicity in your lifestyle. Maybe you can enjoy them. When I said there's no danger to people who get jhanas, actually there is a danger. If you achieve jhanas and get quite a few of them, it's only a danger you have, you end up losing your hair and going bald. That's the only danger. Because sometimes what you get up to in lay life doesn't make any sense anymore. Anyway, if we have difficulty sustaining the first part of meditation of letting go of the past and future, should we not go further in trying to quiet the inner chatter? You don't go further. Just stay where you are. Put on the brakes. Stop. I never told that story. Ajahn Chah's story. There was a Ajahn Chah giving a talk one night. Now, Ajahn Chah didn't really worry about the clock. He didn't mind whether it was 8:51 now or 9:51 or 10:51 or 11, he would just keep on talking. And he couldn't leave, before he stopped talking. So, he was just talking, and as I said, sometimes he'd really hit the spot. A lot of times, please excuse me, it was boring. You know, same old stuff, nothing really new, nothing really inspiring, wasn't really just not on his game, as they say these days, but, you know, still had to be there. It was worth it, because every now and again say something amazing, and it was worth waiting. But there was this little novice monk, you know, the little novices who go to the monasteries because they've got no other refuge, and they get looked after. And this novice monk, he was sitting there listening to Ajahn Chah go on and on and on, and on and on and on. And on and on and on. And he said, look, I'm only a little novice. I only came here because I got no other place to go, you know, as a young boy. And, you know, yeah, I like meditating and listening, but not that much. This is going on too long. I want to go to bed. Now I need only a kid, not like these big guys. And he kept on thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? And it became like almost like a mantra, repeated again and again and again. When is he going to stop? 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 And after, I don't know, half an hour, 45 minutes of that, he got an insight. Insight is seeing things from the other way around. And so he said, when am I going to stop? And he stopped. This little 10 or 11 year old stopped. And when he opened his eyes, it was light. It was Mr. Arms Round. He'd been meditating there for about 5 or 6 hours. Blissed out. Hadn't heard all the monks do the bowing and chanting and ring the gong. Hadn't heard them all go out. He'd been sitting there totally apart from his 5 senses. Having the time of his little boyhood. Done. Simply because he stopped. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Stop. No, he didn't stop. Worth a try then. But that's, you know, people do it. So that's one of the reasons why I think it's really important. Even though I feel peaceful and calm during metta meditation, I find afterwards I tend to get angry even quicker. That means you must be forcing it, controlling it. If it's real metta, oh, you're just walking on air. May all beings be happy and well. And a little mosquito comes. Oh, come on. Just over there is a nice, juiciest part. It's a bit hard over there. Try over here, mosquito. Just really nice. Oh, come on. Take your time as well. I don't want you to get indigestion, mosquito. You're so kind, you know, if you have metta. So if you get angry afterwards, it must be that you've been forcing the metta. You've been chanting, you know, may all beings be happy and well, or else. Come on, be happy and well. It's a lot of effort to do loving kindness meditation. Come on, animals, you know, just receive it. That's not metta, that's controlling. Okay, could this be because metta meditation suppresses emotions such as anger like a spring, but boings up again afterwards? What can I do to try and change this behavior? Kindly advise, thank you very much. Well, if metta meditation makes you angry, try anger meditation. May all beings just really suffer like I'm suffering. May all snorers, you know, go to the hell of snorers. So they have to understand what it's like, to try and meditate when people are snoring. But all those people who just cough, you know, may they just end up in coffins, because that's where coppers should go to. May all, yeah, do anger meditation. And then that suppresses your loving kindness. So after doing anger meditation afterwards, you should have lots of loving kindness. Does that work? You want to experiment? Of course it doesn't work. It's not like it's been a spring. What it was, because you've been trying to control the metta, trying to do it, trying to make it happen. So underneath the metta, underneath all of that, was a lot of wanting. After these 8 days of meditation, I feel stronger and clearer. Emotions like fear, sadness and craving are transient. Sitting and resting with kindness and mindfulness, you can get to know the infinite nature of your own mind. Thank you for your teachings. Okay, so you're feeling stronger and clearer. Emotions like fear, sadness, and craving are transient, but they're coming back. So I sometimes ask me, how are you feeling? I say, fine. I say, it won't last. Ah, you get peaceful again. So after a while, you just stand back from all of this and say, oh, yeah. You get sick, and then you get better, and then you get sick again. Now you're peaceful. Now you have to work. Once you finish work, now you have to be peaceful again. Now you're hungry, and then you go and have breakfast, and then you're hungry again. So much of that life is pretty endless. It goes round and round and round. But it's what you have to do. So it's wonderful. 8 days, you felt stronger and clearer, and fear and sadness, craving are transient. You can actually let them go. Get some freedom. Sometimes I can see my mind going out with wanting, and that I want this instead of emptiness. Can I stop it by any other means than patience? Wisdom and kindness are the best. So sometimes they go out. So what do you want to go out for? So then you start to say, okay, then what? 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 So I remember just, there was a young monk, you have to have fantasies, and then they're just trying to get rich, then what? And then trying to have a really nice girlfriend, then what? And then it's always then what? And that just really spoiled everything. You know, you find the love of your life and you ride off into the sunset, then what? What do you mean, then what? That's it, isn't it? Prince Charming meets Cinderella and they live happily ever after. Then what? You know, the best and shortest fairy tale which I've ever read, it's actually so wise and so wonderful, is that Prince Charming met Cinderella. And Prince Charming said, will you marry me? She said no. And they both live happily ever after. I could... Please excuse me, it's monk's humour, but... So other means and patience, you just say, well, then what? You know, is it really worth it? Dear Ajahn, first, thank you so much for your most valuable guidance in this retreat. Secondly, my question, if it's really valuable guidance, why is there a second question? Couldn't have been valuable enough, almost, but not quite. Do you really want to be put in a mulcher when your body dies? Why not? It's only a body, for goodness sake. Though sometimes people just feel too much about bodies, they've got to be detached from it. And all the people say, no, we've got to respect your body when it dies. It's best to respect the teachings and letting go. Even Ajahn Chah, it's on the tape, he said, you know, before he got sick, he said, please do not make a museum for me. You know what happened even before he passed away? The museum was finished. Ajahn Mahabua, he said he had the plans that if he passed away, the monks should not tell the people, cremate him straight away, and then tell His Majesty the King and everybody else. They didn't dare to do that. In fact, you know, people knew he was getting sick, and so they were there for his dying process. But that's what he wanted to do. Always messing around with the funeral. You know, there was a couple of people in, you know, you would know them, Conga. Probably shouldn't say who they are. They went to see Ajahn Mahabua's funeral service in Udon. And the fellow went, from Jakarta. It was really hard to get a hotel room. We managed to get a hotel room because, you know, a lot of people there. And his wife got sick. So, you know, she couldn't go to the funeral service. He watched it on TV from the hotel room. And he went to the actual service where there's, you know, thousands of people. And then afterwards he said, how did you go at the funeral service? I said, I saw nothing except the back of other people at the funeral service. And his wife said, oh, I saw everything. It was so comfortable. Who are we going to the funeral service for? It's actually much nicer to see it on TV. Sometimes I remember that it was even Ajahn Chah's funeral services. So many people there for the actual the ceremonies. But once they actually did the actual cremation, everybody went to bed. There was only a few of us left. And it was really good fun because when they actually, the Ajahn Liam, this is what I remember, Ajahn Liam, a really, really good monk, so he put a lot of effort and time into, you know, making this big chedia based on the one at not Mahatat, what's it called? What's it on the Mekong River? The big chedia there. I'll remember in a moment. Must be getting tired. But anyway, that he based it on a very interesting design of a chedia, and it was a big iron, an iron oven inside, and he was going to cremate Ajahn Chah's body in that. So lots of people were there, but when they actually did lit all the little paper and stuff and wood, you know, in the iron oven inside the chedia, it exploded. You know, the wells didn't hold. You know, it wasn't sort of engineered enough. And so there's flames coming all over the place. It was a big mess. And you know, I was watching it. Monks were getting the hoses out to hose it all down. You know, totally disrespectful and just, you know, not exactly what went on the TV cameras, but I saw it. You know what Ajahn Liam, responsible for the whole thing? He took one look at it, shook his head, and went to bed. And that was really impressive. You know, everything went totally wrong, a big disaster, and instead of just worrying about it and just fixing it, oh, okay, just went to bed. He really let go. That monk could really let go. And that was the most impressive thing of that whole funeral. When things went wrong, eventually they managed to put the fire out, and then just, you know, the body eventually burnt somehow or other, but it was a real mistake. And big. Good old Ajahn Chah. Good old Ajahn Liam as well. Good disciple. So, if that happens, just why have a funeral for? There's more ceremonies. So, sometimes you can't see the Buddha statue through the smoke of the incense. There's too much incense, too much ceremonies, and you don't know what this is all about. Anyway, dear Ajahn, I was meditating and noticed suddenly my body rose up in the air. I was so scared and opened my eyes. What has happened? You've got to be very careful of levitating. Usually you just thought you're up in the air. But, you know, sometimes it was just the mind playing tricks on you. But if you do really levitate, be very careful. Because it's one of my favorite stories, which was in the suttas. I think I mentioned it to you, did I, first night? But anyway, here it comes again. There was a monk who lived up in the forest, a very nice, good monk. He didn't really want very much in the world. Went on alms round, very simple life, great meditator, and he learned how to levitate. So, you know, he would just levitate around the forest, a bit of exercise, and, well, you know, nothing else to do in the forest. So anyway, we'd, you know, go for a spin every morning, and then trouble was, somebody saw him. It's pretty remote where he lived. They saw him levitating. And the word got around, levitating monk. So soon the villagers, you know, started to see it themselves. And then the townspeople saw it. And then eventually the king sort of heard about a levitating monk. And no, true. So he sent, you know, a couple of ministers to ask him to come and stay in the palace grounds. Because in the palace grounds, they had the king, to make him feel at home, they put some trees there and built a little hut for the monk. Now, I remember that story just when there was a monk called Lumpu Lien, Ajahn Lien. He was quite a very good forest monk. He came to Bodhinyana Monastery for one of the Katina ceremonies a long time ago, and Ajahn Jakarel was the abbot. And so that when I went over to Bangkok, you know, he knew I was going there, so he invited me to visit him. And he was staying in the little forest in Chitlada Palace. you know, in a little hut, which is mostly the king of Thailand, Rama the monk, the previous king, he had wanted to retire and become a monk, and the only way he could do that, you may have probably read that story as well, built a nice little forest, about an acre or 2 acres of forest, and he built a simple monk's hut in the middle, where, you know, he thought he would actually retire as a monk. But, you know, never got to manage to do that. But so he invited, you know, other forest monks, and this particular monk, Lumpu Liam, no, so Liam, not Ajahn Chah's disciple, another monk, he was staying there. So he invited me over there just to have lunch one day, and just to see what it was like. It was, in that hut, it was just like you were in a forest. You didn't realize it was actually, you know, in the grounds of Chitlada Palace in the center of Bangkok. But this is what this monk, this story, the king invited, come to the palace. And he said, no, I like being in the forest. So the two ministers had to go back, and so he sent like the regiment of the army, you know, to make him an offer he couldn't refuse before they knew that line from The Godfather. And I did see that before I became a monk. So he had to come. And so he came there, and the king explained, look, I want to sort of, you know, make merit with a real good monk, and just, you know, you can live simply. What I'd ask is every now and again I'd come and just, you know, learn some meditation, become inspired, you know, maybe sort of get some Dhamma from you. It's just nice having a really, really good holy monk in my grounds so I can go and visit when I need to. So that was the arrangement. And the monk, you know, he'd meditate, always going really fine. But he would, you know, like to do his levitation. He would levitate around the grounds of the palace. But on this one occasion, that the king, one of the king's daughters, who was really, 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 really beautiful, came to offer the food. And this monk was just coming back to land. And he saw this really beautiful princess. And just one moment of lust. And he had to do a crash landing. He totally lost his ability to fly. And so, you know, he didn't injure himself too much, thank goodness. He had his one meal a day. And then he packed his bags and had to walk back to the forest. Took him another 2 or 3 years to get his levitation power back again. That is how sensitive these powers are. Just one piece of anger, one piece of pride, one moment of lust, and you come crashing down to the ground. So if you do feel you're levitating, be really careful. If you still know have lust or ill will, please get a crash helmet and padding. Because we don't have insurance for people injure themselves through levitation. So you don't have to open your eyes, just enjoy it. If you open your eyes, you might see something and come crashing. No, it's just, what happens is, a lot of the time, the mind plays little tricks on it. It's great, just carry on, just nothing really happens. And you're just having a nice time. Is a pure-hearted person also a wise person at the same time? Well, he or she could still have ignorance and lack wisdom. A pure-hearted person, what I meant by that, is that they're really kind and they're very good. Yeah, they sometimes have ignorance and craving and stuff. Like Ananda was a pure-hearted person. But then when the Buddha died, he had so much attachment to the Buddha. Just, he said, oh, the Dhamma just disappeared out of the window. And he forgot everything. And he had grief. His master, his teacher, was about to die. So sometimes we're pure-hearted, but we can still be overcome by ignorance and craving. During walking meditation, I was quite relaxed with lower body, but my upper body, especially from my shoulders, plus my arms, tend to get heavy. I noticed and relay, but they seem to last a few steps and get heavy again. Please explain. Oh, just let them get heavy. And just see what happens. See what happens next. Because usually they just, again, usually what is happening there is when you're starting to get peaceful, the senses get amplified. Already somebody said that the sound was really, really loud. You know, when they were getting in deep meditation. Many times you have things like you feel like there's ants crawling on your skin. Because your senses get very, very, very enhanced, amplified. And that happens with all of them. Sometimes I did mention, sometimes people smell fragrant smells. You know, lavender or sandalwood. And there's nothing there at all. It's just the mind is amplifying because you're very mindful, very sensitive. So if it feels heavy, just let it get heavy. Okay. And eventually it'll just pass away. Have you ever in deep meditation met Ajahn Chah? Why did you choose Thailand to do meditation? Why not India or Myanmar? In deep meditation met Ajahn Chah. If it's in deep meditation, you don't meet anybody. Too simple, too deep, too distilled to meet anybody. But I did remember after Ajahn Chah passed away, having a dream of Ajahn Chah. And in my dream, he gave this Dhamma discourse, this teaching. I remember this. I remember it's like a vivid enough dream. I remember Ajahn Chah teaching, really amazing. I thought, wow, this is incredible. You know, the last teaching of Ajahn Chah, I really got to remember this. I put a lot of it was in a dream state. I was, you know, laying down in bed, fast asleep, or, you know, but vividly dreaming. And then I said, I must remember this. And when Ajahn Chah finished, I opened my eyes, and I couldn't remember a thing. Oh, that was just so disappointing. So, I tried in the dream to actually remember it all. I couldn't. Anyway, it was exciting at the time, but it didn't work. Why did I choose Thailand to do meditation? Because I had enough understanding that if you practice the Dhamma, it leads to happiness. So I just went around to all these monks. There weren't any nuns around at that time, which I knew, looking for the happy ones. And of course, it was actually the Thai monks were the most happy at the time when I saw. So I went to Thailand, and then when you saw an Ajahn Chah, you know, that was really sort of a happy monk. You know, you saw him around, just, you know, what he did and how he acted in very difficult situations. So that really impressed me. He was happy. The other thing which was important to me, that in the Thai tradition, you can become a monk or a nun for however long you wanted. So there was no such thing as life vows. So if it didn't work out for you, you could disrobe. And you weren't sort of demeaned, oh, you're a failure, you're hopeless, you didn't make it. You know, the people would say, oh, well done, you lasted 5 years or 10 years. It was very, very good. And I don't mind saying that some of the monks I ordained, they disrobed. And they didn't lose anything because they make really good husbands. Isn't that so? There's somebody who married one of my ex-monks. They come and say to me, he said, Ajahn Bhav, thank you for training my husband. That's true. But what I liked about that, there was no force and pressure on you. You make a decision to become a monk or become a nun, and that's it. The rest of your life, you can't get out. There's no exit strategy. If you realize later on in your life you made a wrong choice. But how can you just make a choice, especially when you're young, and know it's the right one? So you can feel it, but you keep on going, and because you can always leave whenever you want to, the pressure is off you. So you only stay as a monk because you like being a monk. You only stay as a nun because you find it very fulfilling, not because you have to. And that's one of the problems with other paths where celibacy is enforced. In other words, once you decide to be a monk or to be a priest, that's it. You can't get out if you feel that you made a wrong choice. And that's, I think, a lot of times when people who were celibate start to, you know, abuse their position and just they have sexual scandals. So, you know, if a person does feel that, you know, the monastic life doesn't fit, then disrobe with honour. And don't destroy people's faith in monasticism and celibacy. If it doesn't fit you, then change. That's all there is. But you give it a try, first of all. See how it goes. And then that's why some of the temporary ordinations work, because you give it a try and then find out if it's for you. And then afterwards, if it is for you, great. What I wanted, I know, sometimes, I couldn't figure out how we could do this according to the Vinaya. You know, some people, they do disrobe and they regret it afterwards. So I'd like to have, like, temporary disrobals. Try it out for a week, and then you find, oh, crikey, I don't want to do this, so you can still come back again. Temporary disrobals. Yeah, well, don't tell the monks over the road there, they will try. Because there's another Harry Potter movie on or something, and can I just disrobe until I see it and finish it? Next question. I just wanted to thank you for giving me permission to do nothing for 9 days. As soon as I realized I didn't need to go home with a report to my husband, the stillness came. Excellent. Crikey, you know, why do you have to keep reporting to your husband? Anyway, so stillness came. It's wonderful, no pressure on you. Excellent, well done. Things you should know. Okay, why? Okay, Monday to Friday, she's a teacher in the education department. Saturday, she teaches meditation in Dhammaloka. She makes all meditations, Bianca. But she's a relief teacher. Where is she? No, she's not here. She's a relief teacher. So just when other people, teachers are sick or something. Shakti teaches meditation in Dhammaloka. She's on the roster there for the beginner's class. She makes all the meditation culture and stuff sold in Dhammaloka library to raise funds for Dhammasaranath's monastery. Yes, these cushions levitate you. Of course they levitate you, about 3 inches. In addition, she manages all BSW retreats. Dining hall urn is on 24 hours. She is on 20 hours. May you attain the bond in this very life. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. That's good. Good old Bianca. But she would do that even if you didn't. If you didn't sort of praise her. Don't do it because you get praised. It's fun to do. When I finish meditating, I get a feeling that it's like everything in slow motion. There's also some sort of pressure around the something, the who. Anyway, the heart, the head. Can I indulge in this feeling? Yeah, indulge. Indulge in the pleasures of meditation. That is not dangerous. It is actually helpful. Dear Ajahn Pam, can you recommend a couple of books for us to read further our study of Buddha Dhamma? Read the checkbook. Oh, no, that's a joke. Read books for further studies of Buddha Dhamma. Okay, one of the nice books to read is just so you know sort of what the Buddha actually taught. Now read some of the suttas. They're really good. But ones which have got really good translations. And the other one to read further our studies of Buddha Dhamma is Winnie the Pooh. Keep it simple. Sometimes when it gets too complicated, sometimes that people just tend to argue. Anyway, sometimes you can choose which book you particularly like. There's so many different types of books. But it's best to actually to just get some of the teachings of the Buddha, so you can actually find them out for yourself. Because people still keep arguing about what the Buddha taught, what the Buddha didn't teach. And so it's nice to be able to actually read it for yourself, so you have no doubts. During this retreat, I had some peaceful mind moments and enjoyed them. Also, I reflected on previous samadhi experience and could get some insights from them. I'm still in the midst of mist, but I feel the mist become a bit thinner. Thanks for the kindness and wisdom yourself. It's just the inspiration, Ajahn. Just thanks a trillion. It's amazing just how it has to go up and up and up. I gave a talk the other day on ultimate truth. Understanding that ultimate is always something more than ultimate. Because when I go to functions, they have to give you, they want to give you the proper recognition. What is your title, Ajahn Brahm? And as you know, that you know, after 10 years as a monk or a nun, you're called Tera. Now, that's not pronounced the same as Tera, but Tera. Sometimes people think, you know, why are you called a Tera after you've had 10 reigns? It's Tera. And after 20 years, you are called Mahatera, a great Tera. But apparently, after 20 years, you don't have anything more. So I thought that's a bit unfair. So after 30 years, I thought it should be called Megatera. And after 40 years, Gigatera. So that really suits me. I'm 43 years as a monk now, so Gigatera. And you think, well, what's that all about? This, you know, pride and this status. And so you go to some of these conferences and they have venerable and most venerable and extremely most venerable and ultimately most venerable and more than ultimately most extremely unsurpassable venerable. Why is it that people always want more? Ultimate and more than ultimate. And sometimes there's something very, very terribly wrong there. There's comparisons. There's, again, measuring. So it's great when you're just a monk. I love it like that. You know, when I was in Vietnam for a conference, really good fun, because I was sitting in the back somewhere, and I was a Vietnamese monk who could speak English was sitting next to me, and you know, you talk to one another, and his English was really good. He said, oh, where are you from? I said, I'm from Australia. Oh, you're from Australia, said this monk. He said, oh, do you know a famous monk there called Ajahn Brahm? And I said, I am Ajahn Brahm. Ah! And that's what he went. It was really funny. So, what was the other story? There was the Pope. Came to visit. I won't say which country it was, but you know he was in a big limousine, picked him up, and so he's sitting in the back, chauffeur in the front, and just you know, after a few miles down the road, he asked the chauffeur, he said, "Are you Catholic?" The chauffeur said, "Yeah, of course I am. Just you know, I'm doing this to get a bit more sort of you know merit for my sins." And he said, "You've done many sins." He said, "Oh yeah." He said, "I'll tell you what," said the Pope, "you know I will absolve you from all your sins." Because you know, I'm the Pope, if you let me drive. Because, you know, you don't get a driver as a Pope. They won't let you. And so he said, all my sins, said the, you know, the driver. He said, yeah, the lot. He said, okay, deal. So they parked the side of the road, and they sort of, the Pope got and the driver got out, they exchanged costumes. Oh, no, they didn't exchange costumes. Sorry, the Pope was in the front with his costume, and the driver was in the back. And the Pope, you know, not sort of raving for a long time, put his foot down, just really enjoying himself. And of course, a policeman saw them. And the policeman asked him to please pull over. And the policeman asked him to wind down the window. You've been speeding, breaking the law. And as soon as he saw that the driver was the Pope, he realized he was in big trouble. So the policeman rang up the station, said, station, he said, who's there? It's the sergeant. He said, look, I'm in big trouble. He said, why? Well, I've pulled over a car for speeding and the driver's a VIP. And the sergeant said, look, this is a democracy, it doesn't matter who they are, the law applies to everybody. But you don't understand, sergeant, it's a really big VIP. That doesn't matter. Charge them. You don't understand. This is an enormous VIP. Well, who could he be? Well, I don't know who he is in the back, but the Pope is his chauffeur. So anyway, I better get going, otherwise I'll be late. Can monks and nuns in the Mahayana tradition, or the Hahayana, Mahayana become fully enlightened as well. The less restrictive rules are adding more difficulties, obviously, because they believe in Pure Land. In Zen, they often refer to the Satori as a kind of insight. This is the Pure Land. Jhana growth. The Western paradise in West Australia. It doesn't get better than this. What are you talking about? So you've arrived at the Pure Land. Well done. Now, of course, people, it doesn't matter who you call yourself. This is one of the nice teachings of the Buddha in the Parinibbana Sutta. He was asked, can you get enlightened in other traditions? And the Buddha's answer was brilliant. He said, wherever you practice the Eightfold Path, there you get enlightened. It doesn't matter if you're a male or female or transgender, gay, lesbian. Doesn't matter if you're old or young. Doesn't matter what race, what health. Anyone who practices the Eightfold Path will eventually get enlightened. Simple as that. It's not who you are. It's what you do. The practice leads in that direction. That's brilliant. So you can be the Pope. The Pope practices the Eightfold Path. He'd be an Arahant and he wouldn't need to drive the chauffeur everywhere and get into trouble. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned restraint is in the same sentence as contentment, like they were in the same list, like they are synonyms. How can this be? Restraint seems to have a forceful connotation to it. No, restraint is just letting go, renunciation, giving up. What are you giving up? You're giving up control. You're giving up wanting. You're renouncing your past and future. And what's left when you renounce? There's nowhere. Now and here. So that's when everything else disappears. That's all that's left. So it is contentment. During this retreat, I had some peaceful moments. I did the one already. That's the Thanksgiving one. There must be something deeply psychological that when it's a praise question, I'll put it back in here so I can say it over again. Thank you so much and so proud of you. A teacher being happy, mind, compassionate, heart, wonderful. We study from you, smile for everyone and anywhere, any place, any time. Sometimes not much, I mean. Okay, very good. The next question. What can I do to stop imagining that others are thinking the worst of me? If I can't force change and if I want it to be lasting, what things can I do? That was the old saying, I forget where I read it. When you are young, in 15, 16, 18, 20, you have to be fashionable. You're so worried what other people think of you. You've got to attract a partner, get a job. So worried what other people think of you. When you're middle-aged, you get what you call self-confidence. You don't care what other people think of you, you're going to do it anyway. Now, when you get to the 60s or 70s, you finally find out that people weren't thinking about you anyway. So it means you could only realize that when you were young. What can I do to stop imagining other people are thinking the worst of me? They're not thinking even the best of you. They're not thinking of you at all. Come on. That means you can vanish and don't worry what other people think of you. Because they're not. Now I remember with a monk, sometimes, at the end of a rains retreat, we sat down together and said, what do you think of me? Be honest. And it's really weird. What he thought of me was not what I thought he thought of me. It was totally different. And then I said, he asked me, what do I think of him? He said, you got me all wrong. Because what he thought I thought of him was not what I thought I thought that he thought of me. That's a Zen koan. Work that one out. So, a lot of times, what we assume people think of us is not true. I'm asking about the donkey and the carrot. So, look, if you want to find the answer of the donkey or the carrot, you've got to get it from the donkey's mouth. Ask the donkey. So I can have a bit of faith in my own practice. Is this a process that repeats with Dunha activating again?
then stop, and then the crazy mind, then carrot, repeat until final carrot.
No, just once. You chase so many carrots in life. The perfect relationship. The perfect meditation. The perfect Dhamma talk. You chase that, and you get so close sometimes. So really, really, really close. And you go, and it goes away from you. So you never catch the carrots of life that way. Instead you stop. Carrots come to you. You stop all the craving, just like that little novice. Stop. And you burst out in jhanas.
Ajahn, you are genius. Letting go, letting be, letting come. They're all the same, now understand. Thanks for all the talks. No more questions for me this time. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Feel grateful to have you as our Buddhist master, teacher. Very good. Next question. Thank you so much. I'm so proud of you. A teacher, happy mind, compassionate heart. I read that out before. I put it in there as well. Okay. This is the last question. Dear Ajahn, is the practice of making vow an appropriate way to enhance one's faith? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And making a vow. So sometimes making a vow can sort of help if you know what vow is really worthwhile. So sometimes if you make a vow to be enlightened on this retreat, you're going to be terribly disappointed. But don't make vows like that. Vows which cannot be kept. Vow just to be content in this moment. Something which you can reach. So vow to be content now. That's something you can do. But otherwise, the vows are all about the future. What are you going to do next? And the future never works out the way you expect it to. So anyway, don't make a vow. Make a now. The vow of the now. And also, when you make a vow of the now and it's wow, don't forget you have to bow. In a few moments. Sadhu! 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 So now, make a vow to bow. Okay, see you in the morning. Maybe.
The future's uncertain.